Okay, good morning everybody, and welcome to Discovery 1, Lecture 7. Before I continue, just letting people know that I am going through the pile of marking that I have been sent, and I will get through it as soon as I can. Some of you will have received answers back as to the satisfactoriness of your labs, and some of you should receive some more of those back in future. Actually, the instructors over in India should be marking your labs, but we've got to actually chase up what's going on with that and whether they are or not. So that's why I'm marking everything, and it's a bit slow. Does anybody have any questions before we start on Module 7? And I will activate all of the exams after lecture, which they've probably become inactive again. Because that's been a while. Hey, so has anybody got any questions? Who has not listened to the cabling demos? Because I'm trying to get an idea of where everybody's up to. I'd also like to point out that the labs in each module do not depend on the previous module, so don't stop working while you're waiting for me to mark. Alrighty, looks like everybody's quiet this morning. It must be too early for them. Okay. You just have to write up a little write-up on how you'd make the cable. Grace sent me one that was about 10 lines long that basically said you've got to make sure all the colours are in the right way, and you strip back the insulation and you put it into the RJ45 and then you use the crimping tool to crunch it down, and you make sure the cables are in the right order by googling up a colour map. So that's the sort of thing we need to see, so that you'll be able to instruct somebody
else. You just
else.
Quoted my whole write-up.
Yeah, well, at least I didn't forward it to the mailing list. I was tempted. I thought I'd just quote it instead. But it was very good. And that's essentially... Well, there you go. Grace's workup is excellent, everybody. And she needs 6 lollipops and 4 chocolate bars and a gold star and a scratch and sniff sticker. Which, when you scratch
it,
it
smells
like...
chocolate.
Yeah, good chocolate. And then when you scratch the Scratch and Smith sticker, it smells like burnt out server equipment. Yeah, no, and I realise that, Alex. That's fine. And anybody else, we just want a little write-up on Module 4 as to how you would make the cables and stuff, and make sure you've listened to the cable-making labs, and make sure you're happy with the things and ask any questions. No, as a blind person, you are not expected to make cables all by yourself. You are expected to walk down to the shop and buy one. That's what I do. However, if I have sighted people handy, I usually drop a pile of RJ45 connectors and about 20 metres of Cat5 in front of them and go, I'd like a few more network cables, please, because I usually end up breaking the little retaining lugs off the end of them all. Yeah, we can probably organise that. I think we've still got crimp tools here, I'm not sure. But you might want to see if you can scab yourself a CCTV or something, because you will have trouble seeing it. Or we might take you to the library and get you to do it in there or something, because the CCTVs are better in there. Okay. Now. No, we've got ours, and I've got mine as well. I own crimp tools, both for the telephone cable and the... You can get Alex to have a look through the box if you want. Okay, now, first things first, can anybody give me examples of radiation that is part of the electromagnetic spectrum? Has anybody heard of the electromagnetic spectrum? Wakey wakey, everyone, examples of stuff in the electromagnetic spectrum, anyone?
Infrared?
Yeah, gamma and infrared radiation. We're certainly into Superman-style radiation here, but yep, they're definitely two of them. And gamma has two M's, I think, but that's all right. Any other examples? Gamma, infrared, one of the sorts of radiations we've got in there.
Bluetooth, maybe?
Yeah, Bluetooth is 2.4 gigahertz. That's actually a subclass that we call microwaves. And anybody who's used a microwave oven would know that that's the sort of radiation we use in microwaves. Yeah, my life depends on one of those too, generally speaking. I can do stuff on the gas stove and that, but yeah, the microwave's pretty handy. So you end up with... Okay, so we're looking at the electromagnetic spectrum. I've tried to wring a few out of you and have been sort of partially successful, so we'll run our way through the electromagnetic spectrum. Now, as you know, a wave is an oscillating thingy that... it's when you vibrate something at a certain frequency. And generally, the higher the frequency, the shorter the wavelength, especially when it comes to electromagnetic radiation, in fact, most waves. So we start down the bottom at sort of audio, which isn't actually electromagnetic. It's actually a pressure wave, but that's okay. They're, you know, sort of 0 to 16 kilohertz or whatever. So, and when we say hertz, a hertz is not when you walk into the wall, it's a cycle per second. And they are named after the, I think it was a German scientist called Hertz. Somebody can look that, H-E-R-T-Z. Somebody can look that up on Wikipedia later. I can't bother checking that. Or was he Dutch? I always get it whether it's German or Dutch or something. Same diff, yeah, they're all from that place with the cheese and the clogs and the dikes and all that sort of stuff, yeah. So, us... Yeah, somewhere over there. Okay, then above that, we're looking at things like long wave. And then above long wave, we have medium wave. And can anybody apart from Trevor give me another name for medium wave? It's the frequency band of 540 kilohertz through to 1,650 kilohertz, just to give you a little bit of a hint. Can anybody tell me what medium wave is also called?
AM.
Well done. Medium wave is AM. Can anybody tell me what the one above medium wave is called? Somebody's opened a microphone, but I didn't hear anything. Shortwave. Hey, this might all be good. So, as you go up, the wavelengths get shorter and shorter, and the frequencies get higher and higher. Now, without going into too much detail, it is worth stating that as the frequency increases and the wavelengths get shorter, it is important that when you are building an antenna, which is the bit of wire slash construction that is going to be used to send and receive this electromagnetic radiation, it is important that the antenna be an integral multiple of the length of the wavelength, or as nearly as possible, unless you're getting into really funky antenna theory. We're not going... Okay, so if you have an antenna that is, say, for example, for CB radio, you're looking at roughly 10.5 to 11.5 meters for a full wave antenna. But how many trucks do you see driving around with an 11 meter antenna on their roof? Not too many of them. So we usually work, well, maybe in America, yes. And they have to make the bridges higher or something. So basically what you do is you go for a multiple of that. So you go for a quarter wave antenna, for example, is a lot shorter. And then there are all sorts of other things that we don't talk about, such as where you can get away with making the antennas smaller if you actually use a ground plane, which is where you use the Earth as the other element to the antenna. Don't even ask. I looked it up a couple of weeks back and went, yeah, I think I get that, but I'm not going to talk about it. Okay, so as the frequencies get higher and higher, and your approximate frequency, and the approximate here is 300 divided by the frequency in megahertz will give you an approximate wavelength. And did I say approximate enough in this sentence? Okay, so if I go into the calculator here, and I say 300 divided by 27, which is the megahertz for CB radio, I get 11.111111, which is about right. It's the 11 meter band, give or take a bit. And Obviously, the reason you have to have the aerial being an integral multiple of the wavelength is you need it to resonate. And if anybody's done any music, I know some of you have, the shorter guitar strings and things sound higher and the big long guitar strings sound lower. And if you've popped the lid on a piano and tinkled with all the strings with your fingernails, because that's something that blind people tend to do, you would notice that the longer strings vibrate slower and the shorter strings vibrate faster. Also, if you're playing woodwind, not to leave your woodwind people out, the resonating cavity is smaller for a higher frequency and bigger for a lower frequency. Okay. So we're looking at radio waves. We've got long wave, medium wave, short wave. They decided that they weren't going to go into short wave and short wave and really, really itsy bitsy tiny wave. They decided to actually base the sections of the spectrum above that on radio frequency, as in the frequency, because as the frequency goes up, the waves get shorter. So we end up with high frequency, or HF, which I think is about probably about 20 megahertz through to about 200-300. Would you agree with that? HF goes up to about 300 more?
No, it goes up to about 30, and then you get up to the VHF above. That happens.
Ah, yes. And your microphone is very quiet for some reason, and I don't know why. Have you plugged it in?
How's that? Is that better?
It's much better. You hadn't turned the switch on. It was... that's all good. And then you go, as I said, you go for HF, then you go for VHF, and then you go for UHF, which is up around 400-500 megahertz, and then we keep going up from there, and we start getting into thing SHF. Is that what it's called, is it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Okay, right, super, super high frequency. And I suppose if we keep going, it'll be like mega, mega, incredibly high infinity plus one high frequency plus one or something once we get up. But anyway, so once you leave the radio bands, you get up into microwaves. And then you start getting up, once you go beyond that, you get into things like infrared and visible light, which is something we all don't talk about, okay? What we do. Visible light, that's where you go from red all the way up to violet. And then above that, you've got your gamma rays and all those sorts of things. Now, can anybody tell me, how did they discover infrared? Does anybody know? All right, I'll assume that nobody knows. Basically, what they did was, I don't know whether anybody's ever come in contact with a prism. Those of you who've got some vision will have seen a prism. It's a device for refracting light into its substituent components. And it makes a rainbow, and we're not going to sing the rainbow song, okay? And we're not going to sing a rainbow either. And what they noticed was that if you actually took a thermometer and you put it in the red section of the rainbow and then moved it beyond the red section of the rainbow, the temperature on the thermometer would go up. So can anybody tell me what is another name for infrared? I'll give you a clue, it rhymes with cheat. Is anyone awake? Apart from Trevor, and I can hear myself.
Yes, I am.
I am. Satish.
That's all good, Nick. Heat. That's the one, that's what I wanted. Feel the heat. Okay, so that's infrared. All right. Infrared. Can anybody tell me what infrared is often used for?
Data transfer and remote controls.
Yeah, remote controls and those really cheapy wireless keyboards that only work like a meter away from your transmitter receiver thing. Infrared's kind of cool, but it doesn't go through walls, although you can sort of bounce it off walls, and generally it is point to point. Okay. What do my notes say now? Oh, it says discuss electromagnetic spectrum. Good, that's what I've been doing. Okay, so also PDAs can use IRDA, and some phones can have IRDA, and many laptops have IRDA, which is infrared data access, I think. Alliance, Infrared Data Alliance it is, sorry. And that's where you can beam things backwards and forwards to each other. And we had an interesting, funny story where two of my friends were sitting on a couch next to each other. This was when Gemma and I were getting married, and they kept getting this noise. And they actually discovered that the infrared ports of their laptops had lined up in Windows and said, hey, there's another infrared device you can communicate with. So they subsequently went through and turned off their infrared ports because they were sticking of it making noises every now and again. I think it's 10 feet or 20 feet or something. It's not a particularly high-range technology. It generally isn't particularly reliable. It relies on you lining up the two transmitters to a reasonable... that sort of stuff. So it's... Yeah, it's not particularly cool. Yeah, 1 to 3 meters is about right for infrared. You can also get the, you know, the powered-up ones that you'd like to cook your dog with that would go further, but whether it's going to work or not is open to debate, and I do not condone the cooking of dogs, I'd just like to point out. And that brings me to an interesting point. There is a really cool device called the TV Begone, which is tvbgone.com, and basically you point it at the television and press the button and it goes through all of the off codes that you can, that it knows about, and it will switch TVs off. And if ever you're like me and you've been... Yeah, they're pretty cool, except they're now cruddy because you actually want one of the micro spies. They're even better. They know more codes than the TV Begones. And you can get those on zazz.com.au. And the mini spies actually have, well, if they come up, because that takes time to come up, they actually have volume up, volume down, next channel, previous channel, mute, and power. So they're a bit more funky than the Begones. Okay, so enough on infrared. Okay. Won't go through walls, short range. It's line of sight. In other words, if you can't see the television from where you are, you probably can do something snazzy and bounce it off a wall, but that only works when your batteries are very well charged. Okay, RF use because it has higher range and it can go through walls and people and stuff. I actually got quite scared when I was 6 and the bloke I was living with, who was a CSIRO scientist, told me that there were radio waves going through me all the time. Okay, so I was 6, and that was a bit freaky.
Oh, I'm glad I'm not the only one.
Yeah, I used to go, oh, yeah, the radio waves just travel straight through you. I'm like, oh, my, don't tell me I've got 1287 2TM country music going through me 24 hours a day. I don't think I'll cope. Okay.
Well, the thing that really worried me is that we're in this, I think it was a car park. It was upstairs in the building. It was a covered car park, and we were still getting the radio, and the radio waves were coming through the building into our car. And I just thought, God, I mean, what do they go through, these things?
Well, they can actually go through quite a lot. And interestingly enough, as an interesting case in point, a lot of people want to know why microwaves are called microwaves, as in the things that go... etc., that you put your food into. And the fact is that apparently water will be heated or vibrated by all sorts of radio waves. They don't necessarily have to be microwaves. But it just so happened that the Industrial Scientific Medical Band at 2.4 gigahertz was unlicensed, and manufacturers could make these emitters that would send out these microwaves that would actually... go into food and warm them up. And for people who don't know, a microwave works by vibrating the water molecules, which then get hot, which then warm the rest of the food up. Sadly, this is a lecture on RF technology and not cooking. Otherwise, I'd talk to you all about handy-dandy microwave hints and how to make them work for you. But that's not today's lecture. Okay, so you've got the ISM bands, or ISM, as JAWS doesn't say them, 900, 2.4, and 5 gigahertz. Okay, Bluetooth runs in the 2.4 gigahertz, so does 802.11 wireless. Ericsson did a study and claimed that Bluetooth and Wi-Fi only interfered with each other and caused a 30% degradation in performance. I have never heard any more bull twang in my life. It's chronic. If you have your Bluetooth and your Wi-Fi on at the same time, you are going to get a significant performance drop, especially if you're trying to, say, for example, send a 1 meg file to your mobile phone. You did not what, Scott? Oh, you didn't do a study. Oh, yes. Sorry, I've got the jug now. That's all right. I'm a bit slow this morning.
Dark carry.
Yeah, it's all right. It's all right. It's all right. Hey, I'm thinking about telling you guys the right things, and he goes and throws in a really funny joke about his last name. I mean, hey, it's all right. Well, he didn't do a study, but Ericsson Communications did, who've probably got more money than him, and they reckon it only affects the other one by 30%. Although I know your plan to conquer the world, Scott, is just in its early stages and it's starting to gain momentum. Wahahaha. Okay. So, when you have your netbook or PDA or thing, unless you have a really good reason to, only turn your Wi-Fi or your Bluetooth on or off. Don't have them both on or they will interfere with each other. They are actually separate aerials, but they do use a different multiplexing standard. Bluetooth uses frequency hopping and Wi-Fi uses spread spectrum. But yeah, they do stamp on each other. Yes, Grace?
So I have an HP laptop, and the really crazy thing about it is, if you turn your Bluetooth or your wireless off, JAWS all of a sudden loses its authorization, and you can no longer use it.
That is because the... Yes, when you actually turn it off, the device disappears out of the device manager, and JAWS then calculates the checksum that says, am I running on the same hardware? And the answer is, no, I'm not, so therefore I'm going to lose my authorization. I wonder if Windows activation is similarly affected.
Oh, of course not, or else everybody would be in trouble when they turned off their wireless and Bluetooth.
Hang on.
Yeah, I called and reported it, and they told me to use all my authorization keys and put, like, three of them on there, and they would work fine.
To be fair, you can put three of them on there and then do a... And then you do a key reset and get yourself another three.
Yeah, I could.
With that, after a certain amount of time, they stop allowing you to have keys.
Oh, no, we understand that, and if you reset too often, they'll stop you from having keys, but obviously you then ring up and complain bitterly and tell them that their activation system is broken, or go buy yourself a dongle. Yes, Suman?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so if the Bluetooth and Wi-Fi uses the same frequency, 2.4 gigahertz, and why can't I transfer...
Suman, can you go fix your microphone level, please, and then re-ask the question? You are really, really quiet. You've been running Skype on there, haven't you?
Bluetooth.
That's better.
Wi-Fi uses... No, sir, no. So if Bluetooth and Wi-Fi uses both... same kind of band, like that's 2.4 gigahertz. Like, why can't I transfer files between Bluetooth and infrared? Wi-Fi?
Because they're completely different protocols. One uses spread spectrum modulation, and one uses frequency hopping. So the modulation standards are incompatible. Also, Wi-Fi is designed for distances of, say, 10 to 100 meters, and Bluetooth is designed for distances that are 1 to 10 meters, and Bluetooth is designed for short-range, one-to-many communications, whereas Wi-Fi is differently designed. They are completely different protocols. Okay. Seriously, the answer to what do you do if JAWS loses your authorization is you get yourself a dongle, which is a little bit expensive, but it always works, except for when your USB ports bust, or you run WindowEyes, which doesn't require authorization that like the Freedom Scientific products. And I just like to point out that our curriculums and materials do work extremely well with WindowEyes. Why am I saying that? Because they gave us a 10-user license, and we're very grateful to them. So yes, you can use WindowEyes with all of our stuff. And it doesn't have any problem with you turning off your Bluetooth. Okay, now that we've finished bashing Freedom for the day, I don't think they're going to fix it, because I think their ILM technology is sublicensed from somebody else, and I think it's somebody else's problem, to be honest.
That's exactly.
I think you're probably right.
Because I know the dongle stuff's done by Rainbow Technologies, but I'm not sure who does the ILM stuff, but it's actually done by a third-party company.
Very expensive company.
Okay, wireless uses higher power. We're talking about usually 100 milliwatts is sort of the highest power you can do. And there is a way to convert milliwatts to dBm, but I really can't remember. But I think 100 milliwatts is up around 20 dBm, I think. I'm not 100% sure on that. I have to look that up or ask Mr. Taylor. You can get more powerful Wi-Fi stuff, although obviously there are regulations on how much 2.4 gigahertz stuff you're allowed to be throwing around, because let's face it, there are dangers to having that much microwave energy bouncing around. You might in fact cook your dog, and that wouldn't be very cool. It would be quite hot, in fact. I actually heard some horror stories back in the early 80s, and this is probably an urban myth, but of people actually warming themselves in front of microwave ovens by jamming the door release thing down and turning on the microwave. I really hope that's not true, because it would be very unpleasant. There's another one that talks about the kitten that got wet, and they put the kitten in the microwave to dry it out. Not recommended. So moving right along, you'd need to get yourself a new kitten. Okay, wireless is fairly cheap to install, and it's relatively reliable. Peh. It's not. Well, it's... yes, Suman?
Yes, many couple of times I heard that, you know, the microwave... waves are so dangerous to the health, and what about Wi-Fi frequency or rays? Is it dangerous?
Look, you're talking about a very low power transmission of energy, and to be honest with you, it's my opinion that life gives you cancer. In fact, life is going to kill you. Existing in this world is going to kill you. So whether the Wi-Fi is going to get you, or the truck coming down the road, or the meteorite that's plummeting from the air, it's really a case of odds. And I wouldn't think that microwaves are going to get you. Some people do get a hot ear from talking on a mobile phone, and they still haven't been able to explain why that happens. And there is some research that says that there are... there are people who have brain tumours and stuff from using their mobile phone too much, and that's a bit disturbing. The other thing, of course, that sort of disturbs me is they go, well, that's okay, just put on a Bluetooth headset. Oh, good, now I've got 2.4 gigahertz right against my ear. That was really sensible. But I would sort of suggest that you don't go and... keep the coffee warm while it's in your mouth, according to our fearless leader, which is probably a good thing. However, I would point out that going and wearing a tinfoil hat and stuff to reflect all of this stuff isn't really going to do you a lot of good, but it might make you feel better, so it's really up to you what you want to spend your money on. It could quite in fact be dangerous. Well, we found out asbestos was dangerous, didn't we? And we found out thalidomide was dangerous, and most of the drugs you get at the chemist will kill you. So, I don't know, calculated risk, to be honest. I don't think Wi-Fi is dangerous. I would be thinking some more of the wide area technologies that use higher power, say for example your 4 and 10 and 20 watt microwave links. You wouldn't want to be standing in front of those sorts of dishes. Yeah, well, the electricity used to run these things is probably more dangerous than the actual device itself. But look, that's your decision to make.
I had a cordless phone which uses 2.4 GHz, and when I, so, you know, switch on the microwave while talking onto the cordless phone, it used to make noise like bzzz.
I'd be getting your microwave checked if I were you, mate. You've probably got a leaky door seal. And that is going to be 10 times more dangerous than your Wi-Fi. But, you know, maybe it could also just be the fact that you've got an analog cordless phone and that the microwave oven is making interference on the power circuit and that's or generating RF and that's what you're hearing. Yeah, so there you go. So, you know, make sure your microwave is not leaking stuff. Well, it can leak food, but just not electromagnetic radiation. Okay, it's easy to increase the coverage area and the number of clients on the wireless network, and everybody reckons it's great. Everybody reckons it's great until they decide that they're going to rip out all their cables and install wireless networking, and then they suddenly discover that when they jam it into their house that they've got double brick walls and you can't actually get the signal through to that bedroom down the end where the kid wants to surf the net on the Xbox. Damn. So, what we recommend is a site survey. Make sure the signal is going to get to the places where you need it to get to. Make sure that you do have a signal down in that end bedroom or where you've decided to put the study, which is the absolute furthest possible point away from the access point through six brick walls. You can certainly ensure that you have got signal coverage there. And a site survey is basically where you get a wireless card and some software that comes with it, and you look at the signal strength where you wander around the place with the laptop or whatever, or you can buy some very expensive and high calibrated gear for $7,000 to $10,000 to $20,000. It'll do it for you. I've just tended to find that a laptop with an Intel based wireless chip does me for the stuff I do. And you watch the signal strength, and you can see, you get a utility that shows you the signal strength in dBm, and if it says -83 dBm, you are in big trouble and you're not going to be able to receive the signal. But if it says -20 dBm, then you're standing on top of the access point. I think wireless with an omnidirectional antenna is an inverse square ratio. So in other words, the further away you get from it, the weaker the signal gets. So for every time you double the distance away from the access point, you get half the signal. And we actually call, I don't know whether anybody's ever seen a lot of aerials that when you buy them and they go, this aerial is 7 dBi. Everybody ever seen DBI and wondered what that was? You are not a curious bunch, guys. Your cats are safe. Okay, DBI means DB isotropic, and an isotropic radiator is a radiator that transmits energy out in all directions at once, theoretically in a perfect sphere. In reality, it's not. But that's okay, because we're moving on. Wireless can be reliable in harsh environments, especially if you've got some kid with a scooter that's going to run your Cat 5 network cable over because you ran it across the floor rather than through some ducting. Or somebody tripped on the network cable or something else. So, you know, there's certainly the convenience factor of wireless. And I have noticed in my years of installing computer networks, and I, current company excluded, the average female is allergic to cabling. You can't run that blue cabling across there. Why not? Because it looks gross. Oh. But it's up out of the way and it won't be touched by anything. Yes, but it looks horrible. I'm not having that horrible blue cabling run over that skirting board. Rant, rant, rave. So then, of course, you put the wireless access point in, and then they complain about the fact that the wireless access point is sitting on their favourite coffee table right next to their bowl full of paper that obviously has to be there. Okay. So wireless is good for keeping your relationship happy if you're with one of those sorts of girls that can't abide cabling. Me, I got one that can handle cabling. Well, you'd have to keep the cabling to a reasonable minimum, but at least as long as we keep the spaghetti tangle out of the way, people are generally happy. Okay, there are problems with wireless. Yes, there's always problems to everything. It's all pros and cons. or in this time of economic downturn, cons. Unlicensed bands, other devices can interfere. So you've got Suman's microwave and his cordless phone and his Wi-Fi all fighting it out on the 2.4 gigahertz band. Okay. Garage door openers, they're another thing that runs on 2.4 gigahertz. And most of the cheapo wireless keyboards that you get for $29.95 either run on 27 megahertz, probably around 27.145, which is where all the walkie-talkies run, or on 2.4 gigahertz, funnily enough. Now, some of them also run on 900 megahertz, but it just depends on the how much you want to pay. We actually have 5.8 gigahertz cordless phones because we didn't want them to interfere with our Wi-Fi. Panasonics, they are. And so does Mr. Ericsson. They are good phones, except the keypads are made of that membrane rubber keyboard, my boy, the keys of death. And they pick up finger grease, and anybody who's spoken to the person that I'm taking off there will know exactly who I'm talking about, who's always going on about the rubber keys of death. He hates them. I agree, I don't like the rubber keys of death either, but that's the way it is, and they're cheap. Okay. The stupidest thing you can do, and the stupidest thing that I think about 80% of people used to do, was go down to their favourite electronics store. I was about to say Fry's, but I think Fry's went bust. Or was that Circuit City that went bust? I can't remember. Circuit City went bust. Okay, there obviously wasn't a closed system. They had an open circuit there somewhere. Okay. Put in this wireless access point and you leave the default SSID set to D-Link and you don't bother turning on any encryption because, well, that's all very complicated and we couldn't be bothered working out how that works anyway. And then you wonder why everybody in your neighbourhood has jumped onto your wireless network and is downloading music videos and material that you wouldn't have seen on your computer, and you wonder why all your files got nicked off with because you don't bother with those stupid password things. They're a pain as well. And somebody's wandered in and nicked all of your stuff. In Australia, that's particularly bad because we are volume charged, and once you download a certain number of gigs per month or megs per month, if you bought the wrong plan, yes, there is a 100 meg plan that you can buy from one of our service providers for $29.95 a month. What incredible value. Look, we know you wouldn't survive if you couldn't download terabytes a month, but that's okay. Grace is one of these people that we don't talk to because she's got like 16 megabits in both directions, and I'm sulking here. We've got 512 kilobits. Yes. Ah, there is a 4.95 plan. What is that, 10 megs or something? Ah, dial-up. Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, though, on the $5 plan, you could actually pull down as much as you want over dial-up, and I've actually proved that if you're doing dial-up for all day, you can actually pull down 480 meg a day. I used to pull down 240 meg a day on the 6 till 6 dial-up plan I had that was unlimited, used 6am till 6pm. I downloaded gigs on that thing. Okay. So, you need to protect your wireless network. And there are a number of methods of protecting your wireless network that you should know about. Step 1, read the manual. Step 2, don't skimp on step 1 and read the manual. Step 3, I knew you'd skimped on steps 1 and 2, now go read the manual. I'm really serious about this. Because you all think you're going to pull the wireless access point out of the box, you're going to plug it in, you're going to plug it into the power, and you're going to plug it into the Ethernet, and then you're going to twiddle with all the knobs and twiddle with all the dials, and it's not going to work the way you wanted it to, because your next-door neighbour has just used up your internet allowance or got you into trouble with your ISP for downloading stuff that you wouldn't have seen on your computer. Obviously, it's important to configure all this stuff properly, and there are various manufacturer things called the Easy Config thing, where you sort of press this button and it generates all the keys, and then it learns where all your stations are, and then it's all, yeah, basically to stop people from having to set up the encryption and the keys and stuff. Okay. We'll get back to the encryption and authentication in a minute. There's WPANs, And I've got an approximate range there. They're personal area networks, 1 to 10 metres. WLAN, say 10 to 100 metres. And WWANs is stuff greater than 100 metres. Now, they're just rough figures that I've picked up. They're not in the test. People tend to fight about the different variations. You can get Bluetooth dongles that will go 100 metres. Well, not unless there's a few walls in the way. That tends to stop them. But probably if you had a football field and a laptop in the middle of it, you might get 100 metres out of it. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay, that's good. There are 802.11. Those signals are set by the IEEE or the IEEE. What? Yeah, I can hear you. It's just your microphone level is really crummy. Is it set at 100% in your mixer?
Sir, as you told that, WPA is used in such an environment where 1 to 10 meters... I have to cross-check it, sir. I will do it in a short while.
Yeah, well, I'm not answering your question until you check it, so there's some incentive, okay? Sorry, but I've got to wind the volume knob right up to full to hear you, and I can barely pull you out of the mud, so your noise-to-signal ratio isn't too cool. So yeah, you go check that, and we'll ask you in a minute. WPAN is 1 to 10 metres. WLAN is 10 to 100, and WWAN is 100 to, well, however long you can get them. So there we go. Maybe I just unintentionally answered your question, but there you go. Start run, SND Vol 32 /R. We'll get you into the record properties of your mixer. I didn't know that until I listened to the Jonathan. Oh, yeah. I'm not expecting people to be running Vista on here. And if you're running Vista, then you can get into your own mixer. Is there a shortcut for Vista, though? I've never found it. No, that'll be right. We get rid of that. Well, who'd want that? In fact, start run SND Vol 32 works in every operating system from 95 to Windows XP. Wonder if it will come back in Windows 7. The shortcut for the mixer in Vista. Oh, you can go SND Vol. Apparently, they took the 32 off it.
You can't do the sound rec, though, which is what you're wanting.
I'm just having a look. It's totally inaccessible.
No, it's not.
And in the green corner, it's Scott with his user interface. And in the red corner, it's Grace, who can access just about anything that isn't completely graphical. And it's round one! Ding, ding, ding. No, seriously.
No. We'll fight that.
I'll show you later.
Yeah.
I have managed to get it to work. I don't know what I did, but I'd pressed a whole lot of things.
My audible now?
The sliders. Oh, that's better.
Oh, yes!
You're as loud as Grace now. Now you can sit back from that microphone.
So I can come up my... So now I can ask my question, right?
Yes, you can. Your reward for fixing your sound level
bit,
is...
Yeah, but being a bit not...
So now I'm using WPA kind of system on my Wi-Fi router.
So I'm not answering you.
Know,
hang
I'm
on.
Cutting down my range.
Hang on.
1 to 10 meters.
No. WPAN has nothing to do with WPA. WPAN is a wireless protected area network, whereas WPA is Wi-Fi protected access, and we talk about that later in the lecture. So no, you're not cutting your range down to 10 meters. Does that answer your question? I'm positive. I am so positive that, I don't know, how positive I am. I'm just really positive, okay? WPAN is Wi-Fi Personal Area Network, or Wireless Personal Area Network, and WPA is Wi-Fi Protected Access. You do not reduce your range to 10 metres when you turn on WPA. You might actually reduce the speed of your network, but I'm not going there. The more complex the encryption, the slower the router goes. So WEP is actually faster than WPA. It's also faster to crack too, but we'll get into that later. Okay, anybody else got any other questions before we continue? Yeah, well, the notes say it does, so I reckon it would. Depending on different factors and stuff, temperature, humidity, weather conditions, thunderstorms, people standing in the way. Well, because when you send the electromagnetic radiation... Okay, electromagnetic radiation travels really, really, really well in a vacuum. But as soon as you start introducing particles in the way of it, such as air and water and stuff, that sort of impedes it to a certain degree. And it's a bit like resistance in electricity, but it's the same for sort of electromagnetic radiation. And the more stuff you've got in the way, the less distance it goes and the more messed up it gets, basically. Obviously, there was something else I was going to say about that. Wireless travels really well in a vacuum. Oh, yes. And then there are different ways that the waves travel. So, for example, low-frequency radiation tends to go up and bounce off the ionosphere, and then it comes back down, and that's what we call propagation, or skip, if you're one of these people who didn't do too well at school and can't say propagation, you just say it's skip. And you can actually get quite long distances. I have spoken to England on my CB radio, and anybody who's ever done any DXing has got QSL cards from all over the world. Yawn! But you can talk all over the world with it when the conditions are right. And when the conditions are wrong, you get about 20 kilometres, and that's it. It depends. It really depends on the frequency bands you're using and that sort of stuff. Also notice that having big sheets of metal is going to affect your Wi-Fi network because you'll effectively put yourself in a Faraday cage. You can't send Wi-Fi through a big sheet of metal. You can bounce it off a big sheet of metal, but sending it through isn't going to do you any good. Which is, interestingly enough, why we don't have any GPS signal in our unit. Partially because we're on the ground floor and there's a concrete slab above us, that doesn't help. But the thing that doesn't help even more than that is the tin roof above that. So if you go down to my parents-in-law's house, you can actually get a GPS signal and navigate your way to the toilet. Okay. A lot of people... Anybody got any other questions before I go on? And on.
Suman.
Yeah.
So, sir, what about WiMAX? Even this uses the same frequency of 2.4 GHD?
Dunno, go look it up. WiMAX is so new, couldn't tell you. It's high bandwidth, it's really fast, and it's the way of the future, and the standards have not been ratified. I'm about to talk about the different standards of wireless networking. They are A, B, G, and N. A is 54 megabits per second at 5 gigahertz. B is 11 megabits per second at 2.4 gigahertz. G is 54 megabits per second at 2.4 gigahertz. N is up to 540 megabits per second at 2.4 or 5 gigahertz. If you want to know all that stuff again, go read your notes, because that's what I did. I didn't know all that. N has not been ratified. In other words, the standard has not been actually ratified. So we're all running on draft 1 or draft 2 or whatever, and it might actually change before the actual standard comes out. Apparently, N is supposed to increase the range as well, because it actually uses what we call a wide channel, and it actually uses a whole stack of bandwidth to be able to shovel this stuff through. And I'm not really sure how it works, but yeah, it can. Although I heard something nasty that in the early drafts of N, if you put one G device on your network, the whole thing would fall back to G.
I don't think our network does, but I we do have a really, really strange problem with ours.
Well, I mean, in the interests of educating other people, what is the strange problem that you have with yours?
Okay, this is really weird. I have a BrailleSense Plus, and the thing about it is when I turn my network to B and G, it'll connect right away. But if I have it on B, G, and N, there is no way that thing is going to connect unless it's sitting there for 10 minutes. And even when it does, it flakes out all the time. So, and it, none of my other devices do that. It's just this one. So it's really strange.
That's because...
Are all your other devices... no takers or just computers?
Oh, we've got cell phones, PDAs, a couple computers. I mean, everything except this one device.
Well, that would be the usual case of wireless chipsets embedded in adaptive technology being absolutely crummy trash. And they were really good when they put them in, and the world moved on.
But I don't think you can get a wireless in contact flash card.
I didn't think you could get wireless in compact flash cards, can you?
I don't think that if I did get one, it would work in my note take.
Yeah, well, you'd then have to battle with the drivers. Do the BrailleSense... Can you actually update the drivers on the BrailleSense Plus or not? Because I know some of them are limited
when
by
they
what
send
drivers.
An OS update out, yes, you totally can.
Yeah, but it's like Runner, it's a closed system, so unless they update it, you can't really do too much.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Can you sort of jigger in third-party drivers under it and con it into working? And this is an interesting point, actually, that does come up further down in my notes. If you have your wireless set to mixed mode, it needs to do a certain amount of jiggery-pokery to actually allow all of those modes to work simultaneously. And in fact, you will actually lose a whole lot of performance because it's chirping at all the different bit rates and stuff and sending and beaconing at the different bit rates to allow everybody to connect and use the wireless network. So if you've got all G devices or better, you'd be better to actually set your network to G and N, or in fact just G, than you would to set it to B, G, N. Because the more standards you're trying to cohabit, the slower it's going to be. So if you want the most blazingly fast wireless network and all of your devices are in, then turn off all the compatibility. But then you'll find that your PDAs won't connect.
Yeah, we have PDAs that are B, unfortunately.
B?
Well, my mine's B. My jazz jar's B. Well, my not very well jazz jar is B. I forgot to mention, I think my jazz jar's dead. It's got a fracture in the screen and the speakers have stopped working and it's not very happy, so that might be why my mobile geo doesn't work. So we're going to try it on Gemma's, and I've deactivated my licenses and I'll move it across onto that. It certainly is worth pointing out that depending on the depending on the equipment you've got, depends on what you can run as far as wireless speeds and wireless encryption and stuff. The Wi-Fi Alliance ensures that gear can interoperate most of the time, and they have a logo on stuff. So if it doesn't have the Wi-Fi Alliance or the Wireless Fidelity, that actually stands for, I always wondered about that, then it might not interoperate with the other stuff. Okay, apparently 802.11a has 33% of the range of B and G and N. Yes, Suman, who's now got a majorly boosted microphone and is putting it to good use.
I heard that 2.5 GHz is banned in few countries. Is that true?
There would be some countries where... I know for a fact that there are channel ranges that you can have. So, for example, in Australia, you're only supposed to use channels 1 to 13. In the US, you're only supposed to use channels 1 to 10, I think. And then in other channels, you're only supposed to use channel 14. And you actually set the location of the wireless card, and that actually tells you which channels you can use. And especially with the Atheros-based software programmable radios... don't worry, they took all the good stuff out. You can actually program which channels it can go on to a certain degree, although there is some... They're trying to get rid of cordless phones on 2.4 gigs, and they're trying to get rid of a lot of things off 2.4 gigs. It really is a noisy band, and there's a lot of crud on there. Okay... The range of Wi-Fi is usually given as 100 metres in open areas and 46 metres indoors. Walls tend to slow it down quite a bit. Glass doesn't slow it down very much. If you want it to go further, you either need to increase the power, which is only good if you do it at both ends of the link, because there's no point increasing the power on the access point and not increasing the power on the stations, or you have directional aerials which focus more of the energy. It is possible to get wireless links to go about 40 kilometres or 25 miles if you have the right parabolic 21 dBi grid mesh things. Okay. Wireless client is a device that accesses a wireless network such as a PDA, computer, etc., etc. A wireless bridge is a device that connects multiple wireless segments together or multiple access points together, depending on the type of bridge. An access point is a device that is responsible for controlling the access to a wireless network, and there are two ways you can run that wireless network. You can either run it in ad hoc mode, which is where we have no access point and the channel is picked by all of the clients and everybody sort of just talks to each other ad hoc, so to speak. And then there is a wireless access point where everybody talks through the wireless access point. Wireless access point tends to be a better way of doing it because you don't end up with so many hidden node problems, which is where you've got one node that can't see another and can transmit over the top of another node without realizing it. That's assuming you've enabled CTS on your access point, and most of them don't enable it by default. Any questions on that? Okay, the access point supports clients in a basic area or cell, and that is called a basic service set, or a BSS. So, funnily enough, usually the BSS ID of an access point is its MAC address. An extended service set can have multiple basic service sets. So you can have multiple access points covering a particular area, and you generally wire those together with a distribution system, and you often do that with cables if you want it to be reliable, or there is a wireless distribution system that you can use WDS to tie more than one access point together. The problem with using WDS, however, is it does increase a lot of overhead because the access points have got to talk to each other. A packet from one end of the wireless network has to go into an access point, be retransmitted out to the second access point, and then retransmitted by the second access point out to the stations on the other network. And it is worth noticing that access points are half duplex, so they can only send or receive. Otherwise, if they were full duplex, they'd have to transmit and receive on a different frequency, otherwise they'd be receiving what they transmitted, and that would be very nasty. Okay. The SSID is the name of the wireless network, and every station on your wireless network has to have the same SSID. You can hide your SSID, and that will keep most people wandering around with Windows XP or Vista laptops that keep popping up those stupid balloons that say one or more wireless networks is in range. Click here to, connect. It will stop them from discovering the networks. However, a good copy of NetStumbler or Kismet and the right hardware will sniff out a hidden SSID faster than you can say, I just transferred a packet between my station and the access point. What does what stand for?
SSID?
Service set ID. Funnily enough, if BSS is a basic service set and ESS is an extended service set, then SS would be a service set, and that would be ID on the end of it. Now, ad hoc is also called IBS, or Independent Basic Service Set. In other words, we don't have an access point. Okay, now for an extended service set to work, transparently, cells must overlap by 10% or so. Otherwise, it won't roam. So that's worth knowing. Now, obviously, there are channels. There are 14 channels on your regular wireless network, except for N, which uses wider channels, and WiMAX, which uses wider channels because you can shovel more bandwidth over a wider channel. Channels overlap, So the channels that are independent of each other are 1, 6 and 10. So obviously you want to be shifting your channels around so that you get the quietest channel, or the one that your cordless phone isn't on, because it goes from 2.40 to 2.483 gigahertz, so hopefully you can find a section of the spectrum that is relatively free of interference. Okay, CSMA CA, collision sense, carrier sense multiple access with collision avoidance. We try to avoid the collision on the wireless network, and we do that by using clear to send packets, and RTS would request to send packets. So basically you send an RTS packet to the access point then sends you a clear to send packet, and then you are able to transmit, and then you get an acknowledgement. Once you finish transmitting, you get an acknowledgement sent to say that I'm done transmitting. Apparently that's a fair bit of overhead, and most access points don't turn on RTS-CTS by default, which is why the CTS threshold is usually set to 2,347 bytes, which is one more than the maximum packet size on a wireless local area network. Configure the access point before putting it on the live network. No, you didn't, did you? You pulled it out of the box, you plugged it into the wall, you wired it into your Ethernet, and then you wondered why all of the next-door neighbor's kids for six blocks around had just jumped on your network and started downloading stuff. Configure it before you put it on the network, so you've got all the security and stuff turned on. Doesn't matter how many times you tell people that, they still go and just plug it in. It's like just saying, you know, opening your door and putting a big sign on it that says, all of the money is in this house, and then waiting for everybody to just come in and loot your stuff. Okay, so configure it before you put it on the network. Okay, you can get two sorts of configuration tools. You can either get Windows Zero Configuration Wireless, which is the one that goes, one or more wireless networks is detected in this area, or if you've got Andre Lewis's sound scheme installed. And there is card-specific stuff that tends to come with your wireless card, such as the Atheros utilities, which are quite accessible, or the Ralink utilities, which are not, or the Linksys utilities, which are not, or the D-Link utilities, which definitely aren't. And some of it isn't even JAWS cursorable, because they use pictures that JAWS doesn't even want to identify. So not a lot of fun. And all the controls are non-standard. But the card stuff that comes with the card will often let you do more than the Windows Zero Configuration Wireless. And until Windows Service Pack 3 was released, it was the case that you could not run WPA2 without a hot fix from Microsoft with Windows Zero Configuration Wireless. You can now, with SP3, provided that your underlying hardware is capable of supporting WPA2. You also get a site survey, signal strength, and the ability to set up profiles. So that's kind of handy. Any questions? People like to connect to free Wi-Fi networks. What a surprise. If it's free, you can't get rid of people. They are flocking around like flies to a rotting piece of meat. They will jump on and flog it for all it's worth. I never understood this when I was a kid. I thought that was greedy and rude, and why did people have to go and scoff themselves on a free resource? Anyway, that's just my little philosophy for the day. But if it's free, you can go and belt people away with a stick, basically. War driving is where you drive around and you look for wireless networks with all these funny parabolic antennas stuck to your car and probably extra car batteries to be able to power all the laptops and stuff you're going to run. In fact, you probably don't need the extra batteries if you actually get rid of the incredibly good sound system, but, you know, it's one or the other, so we'd like to have both. And you drive around and you mark off where wireless networks are. And if you use a copy of Kismet and a GPS receiver, you can actually have Kismet save all the latitudes and longitudes of where it detects all the wireless networks and all the wireless network strengths to save you from doing it. There is also war walking and also war busing. And people have also done it in a plane. And there are lots and lots of unprotected networks. And the only thing that's worse than an unprotected wireless network is an unprotected wireless network with a DHCP server enabled. Can anybody tell me why that would be a bad thing, TM? Anybody? Why is having a DHCP server enabled on an unprotected wireless network a bad thing?
Anyone can get an IP address from you and just go crazy.
That's exactly right. Which, we actually have a DHCP server on our wireless network, and yes, it will hand out IP addresses promiscuously, so to speak, but we do have WEP turned on, because our PDAs don't support WPA. Yes, all right, let's all laugh and point, but our PDAs don't support WPA. Ha ha ha. Okay, always make sure you change the default SSID and the default SSIDs. I don't know, does anybody get a bit put off by the silly little speech balloons that sort of say things like, oh, it is the default settings, I can access the network. Oh, they have changed the defaults, I am unable to access the network. I love the way they've got sinister-looking... The descriptions say that there's sinister-looking people wandering around connecting to wireless networks. I always wonder whether you have to be sinister-looking to jump on a free wireless network. I didn't think so, but anyway. And then there's this one where the hacker goes, oh, they've changed the default settings, I cannot connect. You know, I'd be a little bit more expressive than that if I were that hacker.
Yeah, it makes me feel like I'm two.
And then, yeah, exactly. And then there's these girls with these really weird names like Trishna. I mean, okay, international's all good and stuff, but, you know, we've got Trishna and Erica and goodness knows who else. I mean, what about Betty and I don't know who else, but, you know, normal names. But, yeah, so, yeah, the funny names for all the girls that are wandering around. And that's all good. Well, it probably isn't politically correct enough, but, I mean, I don't know what you'd have that would be politically correct enough, to be honest. We didn't actually have any of this stuff previously. We just had examples rather than, you know, Trishna is working on her laptop. Well, good for her.
Yeah, it looks like a sixth grade textbook now. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, well, look, if ever you get bored, go and take a look at the old CCNA1 curriculum, which is still up on our server and is accessible, and read, say, Chapter 3 of that would be the one to have a look at, and see if you find that a little bit more technical. I would point out, however, that these courses are CCNA Discovery, so these are the lower level ones, or well, they say more practical, but I like saying lower level, whereas CCNA Exploration actually gets quite heavily into the theory. And yes, we are seriously looking at shifting to Exploration because this stuff is just naff. But it's very important that you know it. Okay. MAC address filtering. MAC address is how many bits long? Anybody? No, not 12. How many bits long? No, any advances on 24? This is in your final exam, guys. No, now you're guessing. It's 48. 48 bits is how long a MAC address is. It's in your final exam, people. 48. I don't know how you're going to remember. MAC address, let me get it straight. The number of bits is 48. Look, I don't know what you want to do, but it's 48 bits long, 24 for the OUI, and 24 for the card-specific value, and the OUI being the organizational unique identifier. 48 bits long, and it's in your final exam. Okay, I think I've made that point now. Let's move. Okay, MAC address filtering is a way that you can limit which machines can connect to your wireless network. And you say which MAC addresses can connect or which MAC addresses can't connect. It's not 100% foolproof because it is possible to spoof or fake a MAC address. I always think the word spoof sounds a bit crude, so we'll just go with faking a MAC address. And you can actually jump on as someone
faking
else.
Faking it doesn't?
Well, at least faking it is a little bit more socially acceptable than spoofing it, wouldn't you say? Yeah, look, I don't know. Look, if you're faking it, dear, I don't want to know about it, okay? But, if that's... So, let's move on. Now that we've had a bit of a chuckle there. And moving right along. So we'll go back to spoofing MAC addresses if that makes you happier. Okay. Well, it's just I get a bit worried because some people don't pronounce the spoof as oo and they pronounce it as oof, and that's not very cool if you're in Australia. It's not an image I want. Jaws says spoof. Isn't that good? Un, deux, trois, quatre. Sacre bleu. Okay. You can also have authentication. And authentication, there are three types. There is open authentication, which means anybody can authenticate with the access point. And actually, there are two phases to connecting to an access point. There's associating with it and authenticating with it. And the authentication, you can either have a pre-shared key, which means you both share the key and you connect. You can have open, where you don't need anything to authenticate. And then you can have EAP, which is EAP, or Extensible Authentication Protocol. And Cisco has a version called LEAP, which is Lightweight Extensible Authentication Protocol. Isn't that cute? I want one that's called Seriously Lightweight Authentication and call it SLEEP, because that sounds good. Okay. Okay, so open authentication is used in schools and hotspots and stuff where you want anybody to be able to jump on the access point. PSK stands for pre-shared key. PSK stands for pre-shared key. Don't forget that, because you're going to see PSK and you're going to, what's that? It's not a packet of soggy crisps with a misspelling, it's pre-shared key. Okay, when you're using PSK, the access point sends a random string to the client. The client encrypts it with the key. It sends the random string back to the access point. The access point decrypts the random string, and if it gets the random string in that it sent, it knows that you know the pre-shared key. This stops it from sending the key over the network. And we're not going to get into to discussions on methods of authentication and encryption and stuff. That would be a Thursday chat topic. If we could talk about anything in the Thursday chat. EAP is Advanced Authentication, and it's a pain in the backside to set up. And you can set up with a RADIUS server, which is Remote Authentication Dial-In User Service. It's one of those really funky acronyms, RADIUS. Wow. And it's what ISPs and stuff use to authenticate their users, and what wireless people can use to authenticate their stations. Okay, any questions so far? Encryption is what we use to stop people from looking at the data stream. There are a number of methods of encryption. One of them is WEP, or Wired Equivalency Protocol. You then have WPA, and you then have WPA2. WEP has 64 or 128-bit keys, but one of the problems with WEP is that you don't change the keys. The keys stay the same, and you can actually perform a known plain text attack and get the keys out if you receive a certain number of packets in the vicinity of 100,000. And you're going to say, but it's going to take me ages to receive 100,000 packets, but you can actually inject ARP request packets into the network, and for some reason they get through various access points, and you can actually generate the traffic required to generate those packets from the access point, and then you can crack the keys. WPA was apparently better than WEP, except it still had a similar problem with the keys. The initialization vector was constant rather than the keys. Well done, people. So WPA2, they got it right. There are two forms of WPA2. There is TKIP, which is Temporal Key Integrity Protocol, which changes the keys over a particular time period. And there's PSK, obviously, is your pre-shared key if you're doing the home stuff, and then you've got the enterprise stuff, which is what uses all of your extensible authentication. I can't remember what CCP stands for, but it's another one of those things that works in WPA2. If you have the choice, you'd use WPA2 A's TKIP, if you could. Not all devices support WPA2 because it's quite a lot of processing overhead. AES is a far more complex cipher than the RC4 used in WPA. WEP, sorry. RC4 used in WEP. Okay, some can use 256-bit keys, but the fact is that the key never changes on WEP, so we can still sniff out 256-bit keys. WPA generates new keys each time a client connects, which is why the temporal key integrity protocol exists. Yes, Suman.
Yes, like as you told that you have open authentication system, and sometimes I heard about shared authentication system. What is that?
I believe I just talked about that. Didn't I just talk about that, everybody? Shared and open? Yeah. Remember, open is where anybody can authenticate with the access point, and shared is where you actually have to have a pre-shared key before you can authenticate with the access point. So if you're in any doubts, why don't you run the recording when it goes up on the site? So yes, we did do shared and open. I don't know whether you got disconnected or drifted off there. I think I dripped off in my own lectures if I wasn't talking. Okay, traffic filters also useful on wireless area network. The more traffic you can keep off the network, in other words, bad traffic, the faster the wireless network is going to go, which basically involves stopping your flatmates from surfing YouTube. Just kidding. But YouTube is a real traffic hog. When you're setting up a wireless network, it pays to actually think about, there's a word we really shouldn't be using, think, about where you're going to put the access points. Where would be the best place to put the access point? How about in the tin shed out in the garden? Anybody going to put their access point in the tin shed in the garden? No, didn't think so. Yeah, Alex is going to put his in there. And we'll stick Alex in the shed as well. So you've got to look at, and obviously the other thing to point out is that the more elevation your wireless access point has, in other words, if you put it up high, the less stuff the signal actually has to go through. So putting it up on a high table or something helps a lot, because there's lots of stuff at floor level. So definitely worth thinking about where your access points are going to go. Make sure that nobody's going to trip over the cables and stuff. With the really cool access points, you can actually do power over Ethernet, which is where you can actually just run an Ethernet cable to the access point and then run a little set of a couple of adapters, and you can actually just have the Ethernet cable running back, and you don't actually have to have a power cable, which is good if you want to put the access point somewhere where it's difficult to get power to and you only want to run one cable there, not two. It's important to... Oh, rubbish. I'll believe that when I see it. What's your question?
Yeah, so can websites identify my connection like I'm on Wi-Fi or traditional connection?
That depends on what sort of Wi-Fi you're using and what encryption you're using and stuff like that. If you're on internet, if you're on wireless through an internet service provider, that depends on what sort of connection they've set up, and one would hope that they had set up security, although it may depend on which plan you're on as to how much security you've got, it will also depend on what sort of encryption keys and stuff you've got set on your particular network. Okay, just want to finish off these last few points and then we can take questions. Newer firmware, you can got to keep your firmware up to date on your access points because it fixes problems. And don't interrupt the firmware update process, because if it's halfway through flashing it, you'll brick your wireless access point. Bricking, referring to the term of turning your expensive piece of hardware into something that is about as useful as a house brick. In fact, you can look bricking up on Wikipedia, I've discovered. Like a paperweight, which I suppose, and it's important to keep backups of current configuration files, because who wants to go and reconfigure the access point every time it breaks? Although it's worth noting that when you reconfigure the access point, if it does break and you reset it to factories, normally it's going to go back to the original IP address setting, so you've got to reconfigure a machine to land up on that subnet and then upload the configuration file, and then it's all good. Okay, has anybody got any questions, including Suman? I'll even let him off that last question for the day. Did anybody learn anything today? That would be nice. You didn't? Oh, right, okay. No questions. Right, okay, cool. Oh, good. Excellent. That's what we like to see. All right, and I don't think anybody has any questions. Last advance on questions. Will authentication... No, it won't. Authentication is only authenticating yourself with the access point. It's not encryption. So the data will be in the clear. And the MAC address filtering will just limit who can connect. It won't stop you from watching the data stream. So your exact question, will authentication and MAC address filtering stop people from sniffing the data stream? No, it won't. So you'd better make sure that you implement some encryption on top of that.
I think my suggestion would be, in all this, if they say that wireless is only supposed to go 10 metres or 200 metres or whatever, it'll often go further, so be aware of security and just be aware how far it could go. There's an email in my inbox at the moment. Some people have bounced a signal off Venus and been able to communicate from Earth, so there we go.
That's certainly true, and I think the key point to this whole thing is implement all of this. Have MAC filtering, authentication if you want it, although I do find it a bit tricky to get set up and working, but definitely MAC address filtering, encryption, and perhaps authentication as well, if you can get all three of those working. Probably use WPA, WPA2 if you can. I mean, we're stuck with WEP because of our PDAs. And yes, I'm going out to buy a new PDA at some point, so if anybody's got any recommendations, you can email me. I'd like to hear about that at some point. What is a nice PDA for a Blinky? And I don't want a Windows smartphone. I want a PDA. You don't need extra softwares to secure your network. Use the stuff that comes with the software that comes with your wireless card to turn on your encryption and your MAC address filtering and stuff and your access point. Sorry, Grace, you had a question or a comment.
I had a question about MAC address filtering, because if you have a lot of devices, are you still going to be safe if you just use like WPA encryption and do all the rest of it? Is it like super important to do the MAC address stuff?
Well, it's calculated risk. Basically, it's a case of a chain is only as strong as its weakest link, and it depends on what the weakest link of that chain is. WPA is not as secure as WPA2, but a lot of devices won't support WPA2, and there are crackers out there such as AirCrackNG that will do WPA networks, but it also depends on who's living in your neighbourhood. If you've got sort of just regular, you know, Joe Average and Betty Normal and that sort of thing that just, you know, turn on their computers and use them, that's fine. But if you've got Hacker Granny that is going to, you know, hack into every wireless network and, "I'll just hack your wireless network, sonny," then obviously you're going to have to wind the security up quite high. I could probably see myself being that sort of person in a nursing home busting into people's wireless networks and stuff for something to do. Yes, you've got lots of devices and you couldn't be bothered putting in all the MAC addresses. Okay, that's your choice, but it's the world's smallest... That's right, the smallest violin, you only have to put the MAC addresses in once, and provided you keep your backups of your configuration files... you can just add to that list. So it's a bit of work, and it certainly means you've got to add a new MAC address in when somebody new visits. So there is a bit of overhead there. But it's up to you. I don't have MAC address verification on my networks. I've been thinking about it, actually. So that people who think they've got all my web keys and they think they can jump on, I can go, ha-ha, which is all a bit five, but that's just me. Although what I'd be tempted to do would be actually put MAC address filtering on my firewall and ditch them out of the firewall so they can jump on the local network but they can't actually travel out onto the internet. So, I don't know, it's up to you. I mean, obviously home routers aren't designed to be convenient to put MAC addresses in, although some of them can, and sometimes you can only store 16 or 32 MAC addresses in one of those devices, which can be limiting if you've got lots and lots of devices. So, at this Cavi Academy here, we have MAC address verification turned on. We use WPA2 encryption. However, we had to turn off Hide SSID because all of the MAC users were complaining the wireless network didn't show up in their little wireless networky thing. Yeah, that's fine. If you have to leave early, Prateep, it's okay. We understand that it's an hour later now and that not all of you can stick around, but thank you all for sticking around as long as you have, and I tried to get through as much as quickly as possible, but if I just go too fast, then you guys are just going to get gooey between the ears, so we can't run too quickly. Anybody else with anything to say, point out on lecture before I stop the recording? And note tab 5.8 is out today. Alrighty, I'll just hit stop.